Good afternoon. I'm going to call the House Commerce Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and we have one bill on the agenda. Can we start with the minutes, approval of the minutes from February 19th? Has anybody had a chance to take a look at those, and would you like to move the minutes?
Madam Chair, I would move the
Representative Stevenson. I would move
approval of the minutes from February 19th.
Representative Stevenson moves approval of the minutes from February 19th. Any discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails and the amendments are adopted. And we can move on to our bill for the day. House File 4 is on the agenda. Representative Lesh. Hello, Representative Lesh.
Hello, Madam Chair. And I have testifiers, too, Madam Chair.
Would you like anybody to join you at the table now, or going to call them down?
Okay. That'd be great. Whoever's testifying, come on down so we can move on it.
Move things quickly.
What the motion on this, Madam Chair, is to go where?
The motion on the bill will be to move it to Judiciary, if you'd like to make that motion. I hear it's a great committee.
I heard it is, too. It's very exciting.
Probably won't get
not
a hearing.
Not as exciting as this committee, Madam Chair. But yeah. Depends on which John Lesh is making the decision that day. Yes.
Okay. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. And also, I'd like to move the amendment. We have an amendment, do we not?
I do see an author's amendment. So Representative Lesh moves House File 4 be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee, and are you moving your author's amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh moves the A2 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the A2 amendment, if you look on page 1, line 1.19, it says page 8, line 21, delete everything after essential. So if you do that, you go to line 8.21 and you delete three words, prescription drugs beyond, and then we insert what's there, but I don't see where we take away lines 22 through 25. I don't know if we could maybe have Ms. Pompeo tell us how we could clean that up a little bit.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And Ms. Pompeo, would you like to?
Certainly, Madam Chair. This can be adjusted by making amendment to the A2 amendment, and it would read page 1 after line 23, and then you would insert the instruction, page 8 of House File 4, delete lines 22 to 25 on the underlying bill.
Okay.
That'd be my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Lesh, do you have any thoughts, input?
Well, it sounds good to me, Madam Chair.
Okay. If we could maybe just have that read back one more time so we have it very clearly for all our members.
Certainly, Madam Chair. On the A2 amendment, page 1 after line 23, we're going to insert the language, page 8, delete lines 22 to 25.
Okay, Representative Davids makes a motion for an oral amendment to the A2 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could just inquire, we're still leaving three words from 821 in place if this is inserted after page 8, after the word essential, and then we don't delete until we get to 822 through 825, so I would just suggest that we add that to make sure that it's how we want it to be.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Dean, the A2 amendment removes those three words on the 21, on the
1.19.
Oh, that's a difference.
Yep, if you look at the A2 amendment, got it.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate the eagle-eyed readers in our committee. To the Davids motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the David's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion is adopted. And to your bill, to the amendment as amended, is there any discussion to the A2 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Lesh, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 4 as amended prohibits price gouging of prescription drugs from manufacturers and wholesalers, charging an unconscionable price for an essential prescription drug, and requires drug prices for these drugs to be reported to the Attorney General, and the Attorney General can enforce it. So the Attorney General, Keith Ellison, is fully on board with our efforts, and so is the state of Minnesota, who has millions of folks who rely upon prescription drugs, many of them essential. And in the last committee this went through, Madam Chair, I recalled how long we've been struggling with this. And it was in 2000, and I know we've been struggling longer than this, but it was in 2000 that Mark Dayton won a tightly contested primary race for Senate and then a general election, predicated very much on, if you ask the average person out there, because he was driving seniors to Canada to get prescription drugs. He went into the Senate off of that, and so it's been, members, 20 years at least that we've been having to deal with these things. And now, with the public's reliance more and more upon prescription drugs and essential prescription drugs, due in large part to the success, the scientific, remarkable scientific success, but also the marketing success of drug manufacturers and wholesalers, we have a much larger percentage of the population relying on many more prescription drugs. Everyone knows at least one person that has that 7-day-a-week box that you can open up with all your pills in every compartment. People didn't have that when I was growing up, unless you were like 90 years old, okay? And a lot of people have those now. And they're essential to keep people alive, to keep people healthy. And so when one of those in one of those boxes becomes essential for an individual to keep them alive or lucid, and that price gets summarily increased in an unconscionable way, this is going to hold folks accountable. Now, keep in mind, members, that what we're talking about here is situations like the Pharmabro, where he didn't invent this life-saving drug. He didn't invest in its manufacture. He merely bought the patent and increased the price because he could. Thank you. And that is price gouging. Because when you do that and you take advantage of a certain market condition to the detriment of Minnesotans, you're not doing anything to help them. You're not doing anything to help develop drugs, life-saving drugs. It's already been developed. Now all you're doing is preying on the need of vulnerable citizens. So that's why we brought this bill. And I have several testifiers who I hope, I don't know who our first one is, Madam Chair, but if they could come down.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And the first testifier on the list is Dr. Schondelmeyer. Welcome to the committee, Doctor. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Stephen W. Schondelmeyer, and I'm here testifying as an individual and an expert that's studied this marketplace for over 40 years. I currently am a professor at the University of Minnesota in the College of Pharmacy and study pharmaceutical economics and marketing. I come to testify in support of this bill because I think it addresses a real need, and it gives at least one way of holding accountability for the pricing practices of drug companies that actually make drugs unaffordable for some people to the point that it means their very life and means their perhaps death. We've heard stories, we have stories in Minnesota of patients who couldn't afford insulin or other critical essential drugs, and because they couldn't afford them, it led to their deaths. Also, you as a legislature full well understand that the cost of health care for Medicaid and the cost of health care for state employees and the cost of health care for other payers in the state are going up faster, much faster than the general economy, faster than the GDP, faster than other sectors of the economy, so that the rate of growth in expenditures for health care in general and drugs in particular is unsustainable. It is not the goal of this bill to eliminate innovation. In fact, I would argue that this bill will help stimulate innovation because it will take players out of the market, as Representative Lesch described, who simply come in and extract capital from the market and take those capital gains home, but they haven't invested in finding true new therapies that address true new problems. They're buying drugs that they call them undervalued in the market. In other words, I can buy the drug, jack the price up, and take capital to the bank without investing in any new drug to come to the marketplace. I routinely study the price of major drugs used by Americans, and in particular by seniors. A study I published last December with the AARP looked at the top 267 brand-name drugs. And of those 267 brand-name drugs, 30 of those had a price increase in the previous year of 15% or more. So a little over 10%, about 13%, had a price increase of 15% or more just in the previous year. And this pattern has been there. I've studied this market, as I said, for 40 years. This pattern has been persistent for well over two decades. And you all probably saw either on TV or saw the congressional hearings where Farmer Bro was called in before the congressional committee to justify his actions. And the company that makes EpiPen was called in to justify their actions. And what we have observed is that drug companies don't respond to naming and shaming. Neither Farmer Bro nor the EpiPen company changed their price substantially as a result of those hearings. So those processes did not change the behavior in the marketplace. And again, what we're talking about here is a marketplace where a drug is essential to a patient's life and health, and their only choice is pay the price that the drug company unilaterally sets or don't get the drug. And that, again, for some patients, that literally means life and death. For other patients, it means substantial disability or premature death or a shortened lifespan or more disabilities or more difficulty in living and additional costs of other types. Again, the goal is we want to encourage and reward the companies that find true new innovations, and this will not take that away. This, in fact, will leave the capital in the marketplace for drugs and avoid companies walking away with capital who haven't added anything to the market. Companies that come out with new combinations or new strengths or new dosage forms or simply buy a patent and jack the price up. But a company that has a true new innovation, that can be accounted for in this process. I would also point out that this process simply requires reporting of these price behaviors to the Attorney General. The Attorney General is requested in this legislation as a first step to meet with the drug company and hear their case, hear their story. If they have a good story, the Attorney General can just let it go at that point or can engage in a process beyond that. So this isn't, and if the Attorney General decides to pursue it further, this would go to a jury and a judge or another hearing process. So this is not a government unilateral process to set price. This is a process to hold companies accountable for products that are essential to the life of Minnesotans. And these price increases have occurred in Minnesota. I've looked at Minnesota-specific data. They occur in Minnesota. They're quite relevant to Minnesota. And this approach, I think, will help stimulate innovation and will help make drugs more affordable to not only individuals and citizens, but to the legislature who helps pay for health care for a lot of people in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. And normally we kind of run through all the testimony, but I think that we have a specific question for you from a member. No? Okay, never mind. We will wait. Thank you. Are you able to stick around if more questions come up, sir? Maybe not. You'll be here? I appreciate that. Thank you. Next on the list is Will Phillips. Welcome to the committee. If you can state your name and who you're representing, and
sure.
Proceed with your testimony.
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name is Will Phillips. I'm the state director for AARP here in Minnesota, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak to this legislation. With more than 670,000 members here in the state, AARP appreciates, again, the opportunity to support House File 4, which allows the Attorney General to sue drug manufacturers for unconscionable price increases. And we want to thank Representative Lesch for bringing this important bill forward. Prescription drug prices are a high priority for AARP. Our members are 50 years of age and older, and many of them, just like everybody else, struggle to afford needed and life-saving medications. We know the high cost of drugs hurt everyone, not only those who rely on prescription drugs for their health and chronic conditions, but all of us who pay higher premiums or out-of-pocket costs for health insurance, as well as all of us as taxpayers who fund public programs. As Dr. Schondemeyer noted, Americans have seen their prescription drug prices skyrocket. About 30 years ago, the public was outraged over a drug that cost less than $10,000 per year, and we now have drugs that are approaching $1 million a year. And a 2015 study noted that the average annual retail cost of a prescription drug therapy for a specialty drug was more than $52,000 per year. And that's a number just below the U.S. median household income and more than twice the median income for a Medicare beneficiary. So our research, again, shows drug prices are rising faster than inflation and quickly out of reach for our members and others. And I think the other thing to note is for the older Americans, older Minnesotans, for our members, they take more drugs than the average person, typically 2 to 4 prescriptions to manage chronic conditions. And so any increase can make these drugs quickly unaffordable. So hardly surprising that our members consistently tell us that they can't afford their medications and that they're forced to make difficult choices as a result. Last year in AARP's 2018 midterm voter survey, 92% of voters age 50 and older told us that candidates' positions on lowering drug costs were important to them, and 74% saying that would be very important. And we've got some stories that I wanted to share with the committee as well. One from Claire Henn, who lives here in St. Paul. Claire should be taking the prescription Remicade for her rheumatoid arthritis. It's a prescription that once cost $60 for a treatment, and it now costs $1,400. And due to these outrageous costs, she no longer can afford it, and she's going without. She's now getting to the point where she tells us that it's difficult to grasp a knife or a fork. And the reality for Claire is that to afford this drug would force her out of her home. So she's forced into a harsh trade-off that is all too common. And that trade-off is sacrificing her health and the quality of her life so that she can keep her home. She's angry, and she should be. Another story is that of Sue and Tom Counters from La Crescent. Sue Counters has breast cancer, has a prescription costing more than $240,000 a year. And they feel lucky because they have insurance, but even with insurance, their cost is $12,000 a year. They worry if they had just their Social Security and pension alone that it would be impossible to even afford that. So we hear these stories every day from our members, those who are facing serious health and financial consequences as a result of prescription drugs. And the reality of many of these stories is that we're often talking about costs that patients will face every single year for the rest of their lives. So on behalf of them and countless others, it's time for Minnesota to take action. We believe House File 4 is a very important step in the right direction, and it's efforts such as this bill and others that we're supporting that have been introduced this session that could save tens of billions of dollars for patients, for taxpayers, and for our healthcare system. And most importantly, they can help ensure that Minnesotans have affordable access to the drugs they need to stay healthy. So I appreciate your time and consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list, Al Gilbert. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much. My name is Alan Gilbert. I'm a member of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. I'm here today on behalf of Attorney General Keith Ellison, who strongly supports this legislation. The bill, as the speakers have indicated previously, prohibits a drug manufacturer or a wholesale distributor of what's referred to as essential prescription drugs, drugs that are imperative for use for one's life and health. It prevents distributors and manufacturers from charging an unconscionable price for these drugs that are sold or distributed in the state of Minnesota. The bill responds to various documented abuses in the industry, including congressional reports about extensive abuse as it relates to the price gouging with respect to prescription drugs. That has resulted not only in patients being unable to access these critically important medications, but in some cases, unfortunately, the death of these individuals. Essential prescription drugs are a necessity, and I think that's important to focus on. People do not have a meaningful choice. If they need the prescription drug, they have to have it. If the price is unconscionable and someone cannot afford it, they cannot take the drug. Drug manufacturers and wholesalers are entitled to a fair return on their sale of prescription drugs in the state of Minnesota. But price gouging greatly jeopardizes public health and welfare in the state of Minnesota and needs to be regulated. And this bill appropriately regulates the subject, which is of dire consequence to the public in the state of Minnesota. Addressing the high cost of prescription drugs is one of Attorney General Ellison's most important priorities, and this legislation would be extremely helpful in dealing with the issue and protecting the public interest. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And Rick Barco.
Madam Chair, can we ask questions of the testifier now, or do you want that at the end?
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I think we're going to wait till the end, let everybody testify and come back. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Halverson, members of the committee. My name is Rick Varco. I am the political director of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. I'm testifying in support of House File 4 on behalf of our union. We represent 35,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care workers around the state. We cannot deal with the high cost of prescription drugs unless we use aggressive tools to reduce the price. This bill defines an unconscionable price and says drug companies cannot force sick people to pay an unconscionable price. I am here today because that is what drug companies did to the family of one of our members. That member is James Holt, Jr. He is a service worker at Southdale Hospital and an executive board member of our union. James and his wife, Nicole, have been in the news and at the Capitol often lately. They've been telling the story of how the high cost of insulin killed their son, Alex. James couldn't be here today because of the snow, and I'm in his place. For those of you who have not heard the story, let me summarize quickly. Alex was diagnosed with diabetes and needed regular insulin to manage his condition. When Alex grew too old to stay on his parents' insurance plan, he struggled to find one that could cover the cost of his illness. As his mother wrote in the Star Tribune, quote, "For Alex, this meant his insulin and supplies cost almost $1,300 a month. He and I together researched for months in advance about his health insurance options. They weren't good. The best plan we found would have cost him $450 a month for a premium with a whopping $7,600 deductible. That deductible meant he would be paying out of pocket for his medicine for many months anyway, so he decided to go without a plan until he could find a different job with benefits." Unquote. 27 days after his coverage lapsed, unable to afford insulin and rationing his supply to make it last, Alex was found dead in his apartment, killed by the very condition insulin would have prevented. I want to focus simply on the $1,300 a month cost. In 1996, the Humalog brand of insulin from Eli Lilly cost $21 a vial. This year it was $275. Lantus from Sanofi was $35 a vial when it was introduced in 2001. This year it's $270. Novo Nordisk's Novolog was priced at $40 in 2001, and as of July 2018, it was $289. It is this excessive cost that is at the root of the problem. If charging that much and an increase of that much is not unconscionable, I don't know what would be. And we cannot expect drug companies to correct their own behavior. As the great conservative economist Milton Friedman said, quote, "There is one and only one social responsibility of a business, to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profit so long as it stays within the rules of the game," unquote. Most of the time that works great, and we have much to thank them for, but we cannot expect them to solve this problem. When a drug company looked at Alex, they saw a perfect customer. His need was absolute, immediate, and constant. He would pay whatever money he had as soon as he had it, so of course they set the price high. But you have the power to change the rules of the game. You can insist that a person is more important than unlimited profit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Now we'll move to the public testimony on House File 4. The person who signed up is Amanda Otero.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Otero, and I'm here today on behalf of Take Action Minnesota. We're a grassroots organization representing 55,000 individual Minnesotans in every county in the state and 22 organizational members. We advocate for racial, gender, and economic justice at the local, state, and federal level. I'm here today to share our support for House File 4. It's no secret that prescription drug costs are out of control. Yet right now, Minnesotans are facing this challenge all alone. In a December 2018 Altrum Healthcare Value Hub survey of Minnesotans, which you're getting right now, half of all survey respondents reported being worried about affording their prescription drugs. 20% had cut a pill or skipped a dose because they couldn't afford their prescription. These worries impact low-income Minnesotans the most, but even 38% of people earning over $100,000 said that they worry. This bill proposes to stand with Minnesotans as they face these challenges and ensure that no one pays an unconscionable price for prescription drugs. This bill creates a standard and structure to keep pharmaceutical companies in check and a mechanism for accountability when costs get out of hand. Minnesotans are in desperate need of someone to go to bat for them against drug companies. The same survey I referenced previously found that over 90% of both Republicans and Democrats respondents believe the Attorney General should be able to take legal action to prevent price gouging and unfair price hikes. It's time we followed the will of the people on this issue and ensured no Minnesotan has to go it alone against Big Pharma. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the list of people who signed in advance to testify. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify as to House File 4? Seeing none, we'll move on to member questions and discussions. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if the bill author can answer this, so maybe Professor Schandelmeyer might be able to help out. So drug companies oftentimes create new drugs that are almost exactly to the same as their initial drug by changing a little tiny part of the molecule on the outside, on the end, and generally it goes through a testing process, see if there's any side effects, if there's no change in the existing drug. Would this impact or stop them from doing that, or would the, you know, this bill still allow them to do those types of things and sell it as a new drug?
Well, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, that's a good question. I'll have the phone up there and Dr. Schandelmeyer speak to that.
Dr. Schandelmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative, for the question. This bill doesn't prohibit drug companies from bringing any product on the market or charging any price. It does define prices that will come under review. If a company finds a drug that's changed in the molecule and gets a new drug application approved by the FDA, the initial introduction of that drug would not come under question and is not questioned here at all. If they come on the market and then raise the price 15% in the next year, then it could be reported and they could be asked to be accountable to the Attorney General for why that price went up in that amount and what would justify that. So they would be subject to accountability, but nothing here that I see would prohibit a drug of that type from coming on the market.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I'm sitting here, I think this feels great. I think it might fall a little bit short on trying to circumvent some of the things that some drug companies currently do to make sure that they can retain and continue creating large profits. So I just wanted to ask that because that's something that does happen. Maybe it doesn't happen as often as some people think, but we do know that drug companies do that to get around generics and other types of things as well. So that's just a question and a comment, and if you have nothing else to add, I'm good.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
No, I think it does happen. I mean, you know, this bill encompasses of both generics and patented drugs, and unless I'm wrong, Dr. Schallmeyer can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there is no generic insulin for the very reason that Representative Dean brought up. So the bills that you have seen pass through the legislature this year regarding price hiking of insulin relates to the tweaking of a necessary drug like insulin that has never gone generic because of the cat and mouse game. Am I wrong about that? Am I right? Is there generic insulin?
There's not generic insulin. It's partly because they're a biological and they'd be subject to the biological license application instead of a new drug application. And we're just now unfolding the rules for biosimilars under that.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to talk about biosimilars because I don't know
what
that is.
That's a different issue, although related.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a testifier, I asked you this privately. I'm confused by how the current applicability of generics work. My understanding was is that once you establish a medicine, it's out there, a clock starts running, and then at some point, someone is able to offer the identical equivalent to that in the form of a generic. And so if they create, let's say we have drug A, and then they create drug A2, but that doesn't impact drug A's clock in terms of being able to flip over to a generic. But it sounds like it's much more complicated than that. Can you just elaborate on that?
Dr. Schallmeyer?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for that question. In general, if a drug company truly discovers a new molecule that can be used to treat a disease, they can get a patent on the molecule itself. That patent runs for 20 years. And they get some time back for the time to get it through FDA. So the effective patent life for most drugs is about 15 years. So they have about 15 years. In general, that more than allows them time to recover their cost of research and development plus profit plus reward or innovation. When you refer to periods of generics coming in after 5 years or so, that could be a drug company that doesn't really discover anything new that's patentable, but they come out with a new label change that the FDA, that's called a significant label change. It might be adding a new adverse effect to the label, or it may be some other minor change in just the written labeling, and they can get a 3-year exclusivity. We have a lot of ways of giving them additional time beyond their patent time. So exclusivity periods for pediatric studies, for additional significant clinical findings, other things. They can get 3 to 5 to 6 years, or for orphan drugs, they can get an additional, I believe it's 7 years exclusivity for finding a drug that has an orphan use or indication. So there are a lot of other exclusivities above and beyond patents, and that is probably what was being referred to when people discussed with you a 5 or 6 year period waiting for generics. But that's not for the original molecule that was discovered.
So, Mr. Chairman, to testify, so in the case of, let's take it to something more simple, like insulin. You know, insulin's been around since, like, early part of the 20th century.
Yes.
So today, couldn't somebody, couldn't a venture capitalist somewhere just take whatever that was and produce insulin today without any patent infringements? Certainly, there may be a second generation, third generation drugs that are better, but why couldn't the, and I legitimately don't know the answer to this question, like, why couldn't somebody just use, you know, 1950s insulin and start selling that and gobble up market share? Why isn't that happening?
Dr. Schonemeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative, for a good question. If it was that simple, somebody would be doing it, because the prices have gone up so much that the profitability would be there. What you have to realize is, with your thinking, we're all thinking of drugs as having one patent. Mm-hmm. Most pills you hold in your hand that originally come on the market and have a patent on the molecule may have anywhere from 2 to 30 or 40 additional patents covering the dosage form, the way in which the drug is chemically made and the process to make it, covering the use of the drug and the dosing regimen of the drug. So most drugs have multiple patents, and the effect of those multiple patents goes far beyond the 15 years I already talked about. There are drugs that have been protected for 30, 40 years with patents that are running not simultaneous but sequentially. And so I haven't looked into in detail, but insulin isn't easy to make. There are multiple other patents on various aspects of the insulin other than the molecule itself that may well be continuing to prohibit a competitor from coming in the market. We do have three players in the market marketing them, but they FDA doesn't have a process for comparing the bioequivalence of insulins like we do for your hydrochlorothiazide or warfarin or other drugs. It's not as simple as a pill you take. Insulin is a biological substance. It's a big molecule, and it's hard to make an exact generic equivalent of insulin.
So, Mr. Chairman, and again, just keying off of insulin, we've heard testimony in other committees that claim that the markup on insulin right now is up to 5,000% of what the production costs are. So, and you kind of took the words out of my mouth, where I'm like, if someone could just produce insulin that was made in the 1950s, there's no patent laws applying to it. Explain to me why they can't make that insulin now, and then I'm not catching that, because it would seem that would be a pretty easy problem to solve if the 5,000% number was true.
Dr. Schonemeyer.
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative, as I explained, there are other patents other than the patent on the molecule that occurred back. The patent occurred, and it was discovered in Canada, and I think it was McMaster University owned the patent and gave the patent away for $2 to the public good. But so it's not the patent on the molecule that blocks it, but all kinds of other things. They use a auto pen injector. There are patents on that pen and the way you inject it. There are patents on the dosage form, on the type of insulin, the way you diagnose the insulin. There are patents on a lot of other things that also block. So even if you could make the substance insulin, you can't sell it because there are other patents that would block you in that marketplace. The original insulin, I would point out, however, is an OTC drug, over-the-counter. Technically, you don't even have to have a prescription for the original raw insulin. We don't treat it that way. Most pharmacies, most insurance companies, most pharmacy benefit managers all process it as if it was a prescription drug, but technically it's an OTC drug.
So, Mr. Chairman, for the testifier, so if I understand your testimony right, the root problem of this is that we have a government that has created a market design that essentially prohibits competition and guarantees exclusivity to these patent holders. Is that a fair statement?
Dr. Schonemeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We have a system that prohibits it. I wouldn't say it's all government. A lot of these additional exclusivities were requested by the drug companies, and the government agreed to give it to them. And we haven't evaluated the economic impact and the market impact of this very complex web that we have. So it's the interplay of industry and government together that have made it very complex and hard to break through.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, my question is, so thank you for your testimony. It sounds like a very complex issue. I need to learn more about it. My other questions are for Representative Lesh, but I saw that my friend Representative Mahoney really had something important to say, so I don't know if you want to go to him before you
thank you, Representative Garoppolo. I would like Representative Mahoney, to this point, you had something.
To the professor? to the professor. You know, you just said that it's a complex government and regulation kind of issue. Have you ever done a study to see who in government passed those laws and how much money the pharmaceutical company gave to those congressional officers and or senators at the federal level? Because I know at our local level, we don't get to regulate too much, although we might.
Dr. Schoenemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for that question. I haven't personally done the study, although I've reviewed studies done by other public policy groups, and they've identified that the pharmaceutical industry is one of, if not the largest contributor of funds to members of Congress. Members of Congress have largely been reluctant to pass any laws that put any pressure on the drug companies with respect to price, because they're afraid of the threat that if you limit my price, I won't find a drug to cure your grandmother. We want them to find a drug.
Or fill your campaign funds?
Or fill your campaign funds. We want them to find that drug to cure our grandmother or our parents or ourselves.
Or fill up campaign funds?
And fill up the campaign funds. And
that's trying to get a message across here, folks.
That's wrapped in there.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I do think, though, that the cost of these drugs, we'll leave it that.
Yeah. Just leave it there.
Your message is there.
My point across.
Yes, you did.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Weinberg with the Board of Pharmacy wanted to take a crack at the Garofalo question.
Cool.
Oh, okay. Okay, no problem. While he's taking his seat, Mr. Chair, Dr. Sharma has to testify in another committee. He's in high demand, so maybe he'll come back if he can. Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
sir. State your name for the record, and then.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. Not really here in my role as the Executive Director of the Board, although we featured a little bit in this bill, but just. I haven't studied pharmaceutical economics as long as Dr. Schoenemeyer has, but I did go back and get a master's degree myself, and I teach actually online for three different universities. So there is, in addition to what Dr. Schoenemeyer mentioned about the complexity of the drug pricing system, specifically to Representative Garofalo's question of why you can't use insulin from the 50s. In the 1950s, insulin was derived from beef and pork pancreases. And that created a problem because it's not identical to human insulin, so people actually became allergic to the product. So in the 80s, the production of insulin was changed to make it what's called recombinant DNA insulin. So insulin today is actually made in large batches of bacteria that have had their genetic structure changed to produce human insulin. The problem, why it's difficult to come up with generic products, is each company has the cell line, these bacteria, they have a cell line patented. And so the next company that wants to come along has to have a new cell line. And those cell lines still produce human insulin, but some of the things that you don't want to get necessarily, some of the, not really contaminants, but some of the byproducts can be different. And so companies do not have the pathway that a generic manufacturer of a simple drug, like a blood pressure medication or something, there's a simple way to synthesize those chemicals and to demonstrate that they're therapeutically and generically equivalent. It's much more complex to do it with a biological like insulin. The board was involved in this a little bit the last couple years because we did get legislation passed that allows for pharmacists to substitute biosimilar products, which is the correct term when you're dealing with these large biological molecules. But the cost of production, even for the biosimilar manufacturers, is still quite high. So you might get some price savings, but you're not going to get the sort of really drastic price savings you see in those older fashioned simple molecules.
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, and I love this job. I'm amazed at the questions I get to ask and things I get to learn, so thank you very much. So, Representative Lesch, my couple questions for you. So yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal from the state of Maryland on an appellate court ruling that their legislation, which my understanding is pretty similar to yours, was unconstitutional. And federal appellate court ruled against the state of Maryland. They attempted to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday, and the U.S. Supreme Court denied it. What is it about your legal strategy here that I don't know about?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, it's not the same bill. It's different. We have a lot of things in the bill that are different from the Maryland bill. So we think it will survive constitutional scrutiny. And second, this isn't the Fourth Circuit. So, I've studied law now for 20 years, 25 years almost, Mr. Chair, and I've seen a lot of differing opinions between the circuits have to come to a head at the Supreme Court. They denied cert on that one based on the grounds that it was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. However, our bill is different, additionally, we will get a different result in the Eighth to make sure that people who rely on these life-saving medications aren't gouged for prices.
So my final question, Mr. Chairman, I should, I'm happy to engage in a legal debate with you, Representative Lush, because after all, I did go to law school for half a semester. So if you should know that. Full disclosure. Can you give me an example of a state whose law in this arena is working that you would say this is something that, whether it's legal, because the stated goal of this is obviously to expand access to affordable medication. Can you give me an example of a state that is working?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo, I can't give you an example of it. I think this problem is national. There's no question about it. The Fourth Circuit case was denied on Dormant Commerce Clause grounds. And I don't know if you went to enough law school to remember the Dormant Commerce Clause, Representative Garofalo.
Yeah.
but most lawyers, if you ask most lawyers, I'm trying to count lawyers around the table, if you ask them right now the difference between the Commerce Clause and the Dormant Commerce Clause, would not be able to tell you. They can't remember. But point being is that it's delegated to Commerce or to Congress to regulate commerce between the states. That the Commerce Clause had a peak. In 1938, when an Ohio farmer was told by the federal government that he could not feed his own cattle wheat grown on his own farm because it interfered with Congress's regulation of state commerce, because he didn't buy that wheat on the private market to feed cattle, so it affected the price of the larger market. That was the high watermark of the Commerce Clause, and essentially, constitutionally, we've been going downhill since then. Eventually, that was overturned as well, and it had to do a lot with the Supreme Court's fight with FDR on the New Deal programs. But point being, more and more so, the court has been allowing states to solve problems that the federal government has not been solving. And I think that whether it's Minnesota's the first one or some other state, we will find a way to solve this problem because the current situation is not sustainable.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me my questions. And I'll just say good luck to you, Representative Lush. Back in Babylon about 4,000 years ago, they tried regulating the price of grain, and it didn't work. And for 4,000 years, price controls haven't worked in many situations and very many commodities. And I don't think that you, even though you have a better legal mind than me, I don't think that you're going to be able to make price controls work after 4,000 years of failure. But I do wish you good luck in your goals.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garofalo, thank you. I would only state that in most cases, Representative Garofalo, I actually agree with you in most cases. But what I think when situations get so egregious and so unconscionable, inevitably someone steps in to try to do that, and that's what you're seeing now is bills being offered. Mine's not the only one. We've got insulin bills and everything because people are just screaming, this is outrageous. And so someone tries to do something on some level, whether it's a lawsuit or whether it's a legislation or something. And I think you're seeing this effort because of how bad it is. But I appreciate the comments.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wanted to get kind of into the nuts and bolts of how do we actually accomplish this, and I'm wondering if maybe the gentleman from the Attorney General's office could come back down, if that's what he was testifying on behalf of the Attorney General's office. Is that correct? Mr. Gilbert? I have served as Representative Mahoney and Garofalo have on the Energy Committee, different iterations of it. And so I was sitting here kind of sidebarring with Representative Garofalo and talking about the PUC. So that's the huge regulatory agency that we have tasked to determine price for energy, right? So I happen to know that when Xcel Energy goes for a rate case, it takes 18 months to figure out one rate, or you know, a subset of rates, I should say, for Xcel Energy. And they have a massive infrastructure. They have lots of accountants and lawyers back and forth and back and forth. So I know how, I know a little bit at a high level how that works. And I'm just wondering, how much infrastructure are we going to have to create? How many folks are we going to have at the Attorney General's office to accomplish the equivalent of what the PUC does for, you know, regulating prices for energy when we're talking about, I don't know, how many different pharmaceutical drugs are we talking? Hundreds? I think that was, you know, instead of like a subset, a small set of energy prices that take 18 months to determine a rate case. So how are we going to accomplish this, and how many people is this going to take, and how much money is this going to take to actually accomplish creating an entire regulatory structure for every pharmaceutical drug that meets this criteria in the state of Minnesota? I'm just baffled as to how we would even accomplish this. I mean, it's a lofty goal. It's a great goal. I don't disagree. I have a daughter-in-law who's on, she's a type 1 diabetic, is on insulin, and it's expensive, and she becomes, as the testimony came, she's allergic to almost all of them except one, and I understand that, but how do we get this done?
Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Attorney General does this all the time in consumer cases, and this is a consumer case very similar to what we're used to, in the sense that the Attorney General has the authority to do what's referred to as pre-litigation discovery under Section 8.31. And what the Attorney General would do if there were cause, if there was cause for concern, would ask a particular pharmaceutical company or distributor for their justification for a price that there might be some question as to whether it's unconscionable. And to assume that every drug necessarily is going to be challenged in terms of their pricing, I think is not accurate. I think that what would happen is that, first of all, once the bill passes, that the pharmaceutical companies and the distributors will take notice of that law, and hopefully that's going to deter them from charging outrageous prices. And to the extent it doesn't deter some, then the Attorney General has the authority, as I indicated, to do what's referred to as pre-litigation discovery, to determine whether there's a case to be made as to the unconscionability of that price. And that's how all the consumer cases work. So this is something the Attorney General's office is very used to. It works very well. And this Section 8.31 has provided for that authority for decades. So I don't see that it would operate any differently. In terms of the PUC, they have a whole different process, as you suggest. And they have a process because they're setting rates for consumers, they're setting rates for businesses and things of that kind as it relates to utility use. That wouldn't be the same thing here. They're not, the AG wouldn't be setting a rate. The AG, pursuant to this legislation, would be deciding whether a charge that is being made, or the pricing of a particular pharmaceutical company, whether it meets the standard of unconscionability. So the AG wouldn't say, no, you can only charge this amount, or we're going to set your rate. That's not what the AG would do. The AG would just be a check on that process. And there is a need for that at this point in time because of the ballooning pricing of pharmaceuticals. So, again, the legislation would be a deterrent, I would hope and I would think. But in addition to that, to the extent the AG has to pursue discovery, the AG would do that just like the AG does in all consumer cases.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would be some of the aspects of that discovery? So are you asking them to provide, you know, open up their books and look at how much they're spending on salary for research and marketing? And, I mean, you're talking about something that's marketed across the entire United States, not just in Minnesota. So what's the process by which you're compelling them to open up all their books and tell you all that information?
Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, when you say open up their books, I'm not sure how much of book opening there would be necessarily, but I'd refer you to Subdivision 3 of the bill, and it talks about they shouldn't charge an unconscionable price for an essential prescription drug. And then that is defined elsewhere in the bill to mean that a price is unconscionable if it's not reasonably related to their costs. So what I would anticipate is that if there's reason to believe that a particular manufacturer on a particular drug was charging an unconscionable price, that the Attorney General would ask for this discovery in the form of, please tell us how that price is reasonably based within the meaning of the statute. And again, we do that all the time in consumer cases, where we communicate with a company and we say, we're getting these kinds of complaints about your activity, and please tell us what your position is as to why that particular representation wasn't false or wasn't misleading. Here it would be, please tell us your position as to why that price is reasonably based. And again, under the statute, it has to be reasonably based upon the cost of invention, the cost of distribution, the cost of selling, any cost that they have that can justify that price. That's what they would communicate to the Attorney General's office. And then the Attorney General's office would have to look at it and make a judgment under the circumstances as to whether it's unconscionable, or at least there's a basis to believe that there is. And in like all other consumer cases, there would be a continuing dialogue with that company in terms of, well, thank you for your information, but here's concerns that we have, or thank you for the information, and we understand that it is reasonably priced under the circumstance. So, again, it's no different than any of our other consumer cases, and that's how I would see the process working.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, can you give me an example of a multi-billion dollar company like Big Pharma, you know, Merck, Pfizer, just, you know, name whoever, that you have done something similar, that, you know, one drug alone coming to market's over $1 billion just in research? So I'm just wondering, that's there's a lot of moving parts to try to determine whether or not it's price gouging or not. I'm just wondering, you know, do you have other examples where you've been able to determine that? And
Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, are you referring to price gouging in particular or other consumer cases?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm referring to, you had said that you've done other consumer cases, and I'm just wondering how big of consumer cases have you done? Because, you know, pharma is massive. It's a multi-billion dollar. Just one is, you know, Merck, Pfizer. They're just massive companies that have, like I was saying, just one drug alone to get it to market is over $1 billion just in research. So I'm just asking, do you have some like cases you know, that kind of numbers and that kind of company that you've been dealing with? This is an international massive company, and just wondering if you've done that.
Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, absolutely we have. Okay. And I won't mention any current cases because I don't want to just focus on particular companies, but these are multi-billion dollar companies. But I can tell you some in the past, for example, annuity companies, Allianz, I can tell you that because it's a public record now, and they agreed to a settlement of, I won't estimate, many hundreds of millions of dollars at least. You know, other very large companies, the 3M case, we had a resolution of that. Now, that was an environmental case, but still, it's a big company, to your point. But yeah, there's many big companies that we have opposed in terms of the consumer case law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Lesch and the committee. I'm just curious, as I look at the retroactive date to the 2014, do you have any idea specifically what drugs would be affected by this?
Representative Lesch.
Well, Ms. Chair and Representative Crescia, I don't have a laundry list of what that is, of what those drugs are, but I do know that there are many folks today who are paying unconscionable prices based on increases that happened back to 2014. And I would expect that if complaints were raised with the Attorney General's office, I wouldn't want one of these unfortunate senior citizens in Minnesota to approach the Attorney General's office and have them say, too bad, so sad they got in just under the wire and increased it in November. Hence, we moved it back to 2014. So I don't know what that list would be. I'm sorry, I don't really have an answer for you with it. Oh, Mr. Gilbert, might.
Mr. Gilbert.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for one, I understand that insulin dates back to that point in time. But I want to be very clear that under the law, if someone is charging an unconscionable price as of the effective date of this, when it's passed by the legislature, the Attorney General would be able to go after that particular pricing. Where the retroactivity would kick in is, for example, with respect to insulin, if there was sales in the past, because the act would be retroactive, there could be a damages claim as to past activity. But to the extent someone is charging an unconscionable price as of the effective date of the bill, that's not a retroactive application. That's a future application based upon what they're charging at that point in time.
Okay. Representative Crescia.
Thank you. And so just to follow up, so a couple things I've heard that I just want to follow up. So you mentioned insulin a couple times. Is that really the target of this? Is that why 2014 was picked rather than 2013? I'm assuming we have to start somewhere, and is that just a date pulled from the air to get after insulin? How did you arrive there?
Representative Lesch?
Yeah, if Mr. Gilbert could answer that.
Mr. Gilbert? Thank
you. Mr. Chair, Representative, we're aware of the application of that provision to insulin, and that is a huge issue in the state of Minnesota, as has been testified to already. There's the purpose section of the bill references more than 325,000 people in the state of Minnesota who are diabetic. So we anticipate that could well be an ongoing problem, and again, it's been a past problem as well, as testified to. It doesn't, the retroactivity provision is not necessarily limited to insulin, though. We have reason to believe, and we're aware from talking to Dr. Schondelmeyer and others, that there's other drugs whose prices have been suspect, let's say, in the past, and that provision could have application to those. The date that was selected coincides to some extent with the six-year statute of limitations going back, so that's part of the rationale as well, just in terms of doing that.
Mr. Crescia.
Thank you, and thank you for the responses. One other thing I'm trying to understand is, so how do we arrive to the number of unconscionable? And I'm really just interested more in this, but I mean, as you said, we have to do something, and there's some egregious, there's been some hardship on prices, but how do we get to unconscionable? How does that term become an economic term?
Well, I have my answer, Mr. Chair, and Representative Crescia, and I think maybe Mr. Gilbert will have his own answer, too. Using the phrase unconscionable to me is important because it is nebulous enough whereby we can get to the real bad actors and also allow those folks who have raised prices, because you can raise prices on your drugs. I mean, you have a right to make a reasonable profit. You may even have a right to make an excessive profit. but the unconscionable, the intent of that is to raise it to such a level where it would raise the eyebrows of any jurist or any juror and say, this is ridiculous. And I recall, and I think I mentioned this in the last committee, other laws that we apply nebulous terminology to. For example, I think I wrote my open or closed brief on sexual harassment in law school as a 1L, and it was on, you know, also intentional infliction of emotional distress, and the legal standard for them back then in the 90s was that the type of behavior that caused anyone to throw up their hands and say, outrageous, which is really specific to put you on notice as an employer or something like that, but that was it. And it was stated in that way, and that was common law, not statutory law, specifically to ensure that we only got the real bad actors. So that's why I support the use of the phrase unconscionable, and I understand that, let's say, as a drug wholesaler manufacturer, in general, I'm going to want to be put on more specific notice as to how far I can move up to the line. But I think in this case, we're actually protecting folks who are not the real bad actors. I would also note this, that I think the major manufacturers, they're not going to be the ones that we're catching in this. They are, well, not as susceptible to the whims of public disapproval as legislators are. They still don't like publicity in general, and they stay away from it. What we're looking at is these folks who don't care. They have no such qualms about it, like the Pharma Bro or these other folks who could buy up a drug for this reason just as much as their hedge fund managers or whatever, folks like that. That's who I think we're going to end up getting at, and that's why, to me, I think the term unconscionable is important. And maybe Mr. Gilbert has some answer.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree with Representative Lesch that, you know, there's some subjectivity perhaps to that phrase, but it has a legal meaning. And there's an unconscionability doctrine in most states, including Minnesota. And essentially, it's defined in the way Representative Lesch has indicated, I think, that it's under the circumstances, it's just not reasonable. And that's why the definition here as to unconscionable price refers to reasonableness, but also refers to a second element of this unconscionability doctrine, and that is, does it result in someone not having a meaningful choice? And sometimes that's referred to as an adhesion contract, where you've got two parties of unequal bargaining power, and that's where unconscionability comes up as well. And that's a part of this definition, so that to the extent the price is not reasonably justified by the costs of the pharmaceutical company, for example, and it results in no reasonable choice by the consumer, because the consumer has an absolute need for this drug, and there's no other alternative for that person to find such a drug, that would be unconscionable, and it's consistent with the unconscionability doctrine you see in legal cases.
Last one.
Mr. Krisha.
And thank you. And so the last question I have, just to follow up on this line, and it's very interesting, actually. Is there any role the state plays in making that these, to your point, I can't remember all the phrases you use, but making this unconscionable. In other words, have we drawn boundaries? In other words, say you can't go to Canada, or you can't. I mean, has the state made this in such a way that it puts consumers in this position?
Mr. Gilbert?
Made this in terms of the statute that's being proposed?
Made this situation.
Made this situation. You know, again, in terms of unconscionability, which you're focused on, it's based upon the circumstances. So the circumstances could bring into play a number of different considerations. But the focus is on what's in the statute in terms of, is there a reasonable justification based upon the cost to the manufacturer or the distributor to justify that price? And again, does the consumer have any meaningful alternative other than paying that unconscionable price, even if they could?
Very good. Thank you.
Want to alert members that just before 3:45, which is our normal adjourning time, and there's about 5 people on the list. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I just wanted to thank Mr. Varco for sharing the story of my constituents and neighbors, the Smith-Holtz and Alex Story, and you talk about unconscionable. I mean, that's what we're talking about. Just a quick question and a comment. To the bill, clearly insulin falls into a category of an essential medication for folks on type 1 diabetes. It's as essential as water is to all of us. But do you have a sense of how many medications we're talking about here overall that would sort of fit into that group, kind of what we're talking about here?
Mr. Gilbert?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be a large number, and the definition of essential prescription drug is those drugs covered by Medicaid, for example, and so it would be a large number of drugs.
Thank you. I think it makes sense to start there. There's also such a challenge for folks that are on medication, the rheumatoid arthritis example, the chronic need for medication that people are gouged as well. But I appreciate the focus there. And just quick comment, the thing that jumps out at me from the testimony, again, I think it was Mr. Varka who referenced the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think this bill sort of gets at. And I guess to Representative Garofalo's point, I think at all levels of government, we are accountable as elected officials, and the big pharma lobbyists and industry, et cetera, in creating this game. And it's incredibly complex, and it's incredibly weighted in the favor of these large drug companies. This is a game that is so infuriating for the general public to play when they see their medication continue to go on up and up and up. And part of the game is also seen in the letter here from the pharma lobbyists, in which there's, again, this sort of finger-pointing about whether it's the pharmaceutical manufacturers that are responsible for the big prices, whether it's insurance companies, whether it's pharmacy benefit managers. It's very complex. And that's why, as Representative Lesh mentioned, there's a number of bills kind of targeted on this. But I just wanted to call out that the rules of the game are what needs to change. And this bill is a step in the right direction. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is to the bill author. And it also goes back to something that Representative Garofalo and Representative Lesh, the bill author, were engaged in conversation on. And the issue was brought up by Representative Garofalo that the Supreme Court refused to hear Maryland's appeal on this, and Representative Lesh, you indicated that it came from the Fourth Circuit. And then you went on to say that there's different opinions that can come from the circuits, but I wanted to just clarify. It sounded to me like you expect there to be litigation on this because you used the words, and we'll have a different outcome in the Eighth Circuit. Can you explain to me if you believe that we will have litigation on this bill if it becomes law as written, and if we are going to, what in here gives you pause to say that the Eighth Circuit would rule with you and we would not be in the same situation that the Fourth Circuit was? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. By the Eighth Circuit, I meant geography. And I meant that we'll have a different outcome because I think we have smart pharma CEOs here in Minnesota and in the Midwest, and they would be very, very foolish to sue to block the application of this law. So I don't think it will happen at all. We'll have a different outcome because of that, and consumers in Minnesota will have access to fair drug pricing for essential pharmaceuticals.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesh, I applaud your confidence in your legislation here, but I'm not sure that you have, and maybe you do have some inside track with the Eighth Circuit and how they might rule on this, but I guess I would, in the way of building a legislative record on this, be wanting to be very clear. Do you believe that there will be litigation on this bill the way it's written? Because I didn't hear the answer to that question. And then number two, additional question on it is, what's different about this bill that would give people a reason not to want to litigate this and then test its viability in front of the Supreme Court again.
Representative Lesh.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Adrinskill, no, I don't have any inside track to who's going to sue whom for what 6 months from now or 6 years from now. So I have no reason to believe that anyone would sue anyone over this. It's perfectly good law. I also think that, to the extent people do sue others, that we generally do have better decisions in the Eighth Circuit than they do out on the East Coast. Also, I would add that, yes, the law is different. It's written differently. It's not the same thing as Maryland. And to that, I would hope, Ms. Chair, if you'd allow me to defer to Mr. Gilbert to delineate how it is different.
Mr. Gilbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I'd like to give some background on the legal issue that you've raised. First of all, that Fourth Circuit decision that you refer to was a 2-1 decision. So, and there was an extremely strong dissent in that case. And the dissent was based upon, if you're familiar with the extraterritoriality doctrine, it was based upon the reality of the modern economy. To the extent that the dissent was troubled with what the majority said, it was based upon just the reality of the world, in that pharmaceutical companies are national, international companies, and they're selling product into all the states. Something else that's really significant is the Wayfair case that was decided after the Fourth Circuit decision. And you're probably familiar with the Wayfair case because it deals with youth taxes and sales taxes in the state of Minnesota. And that case overruled years of precedent of the Supreme Court as it relates to the Commerce Clause. And in that case, the issue was, did a company have to have a physical presence in the state of Minnesota to be required to collect a youth tax or a sales tax? And there were decades of case law from the U.S. Supreme Court that said you have to. The U.S. Supreme Court said that's antiquated. It's not consistent with the modern economy anymore, just like the dissent said in the Fourth Circuit decision. And as a result, Minnesota is now collecting taxes, because what the court did is they said it's antiquated to say that you have to have a physical presence in the state, and we're not going to require it under the Commerce Clause. And in so doing, they didn't even mention the extraterritoriality doctrine, which is something, as Representative Lesh has indicated, has been in great dispute in recent years. Something else that's rather significant, too, is the fact that drug manufacturers and wholesalers are actually licensed in the state of Minnesota. And if, in fact, there was a Commerce Clause concern as it relates to that, they wouldn't be subject to licensure. But they not only are licensed, they've never, to the best of my knowledge, objected to that licensure. And in fact, this bill amends the licensure statute for pharmaceutical companies and wholesalers to provide for this price gouging law, so that they have to comply with the price gouging law as they have to comply with all sorts of other laws, including they have to act ethically under the law. And then in terms of other cases, there's a case, as I think you've indicated, Representative Lesh, from the Eighth Circuit. It's out of Arkansas, that deals with PBMs and the pricing regulations based upon our Arkansas statute, that Arkansas District Court found that the Commerce Clause was not violated with respect to that pricing. There's a similar decision from the First Circuit from 2005, the Roe case, where the court found the same thing. So there's lots of reasons to think that if this was challenged, that a court could easily go a different way than the other court did. And then in response to your question about what's different about our law than the Maryland law talked about whether the drug is made available in the state. This law actually talks about the prohibition of Subdivision 3. It says no drug manufacturer or wholesale drug distributor shall charge or cause to be charged in Minnesota an unconscionable price for an essential prescription drug sold in Minnesota. And that was the issue in that Fourth Circuit case. And there was some some divisiveness between the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion as to what that phrase meant, made available in the state of Maryland. Here, there's no question what's covered. It says, no drug manufacturer or wholesale drug distributor shall charge or cause to be charged in Minnesota an unconscionable price for an essential prescription drug sold in Minnesota. So it's limited to Minnesota sales, and there's no question about that. There's other legal niceties I could refer to, but I think that's probably enough at this point in time.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, this will be my last question, and it sounds like the Solicitor General and the bill author are very confident in the integrity of the bill and its meaning. I just would like the author then to comment on why the severability clause, if he is so confident about the integrity of the bill, its viability in court, that we put severability in. And like many in this committee, I didn't go to law school, but I have learned, including from the bill author, on many other occasions what severability means when he has raised that issue, like I am doing in committee today. The reason you put severability clauses in is you don't think the thing is going to stand up, and you're hoping to save something on the sinking ship as it goes down. So maybe Representative Lesch wants to comment about the need for the severability in his airtight otherwise bill.
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, I also write contracts, just as I draft legislation. And in any of those contracts, I always include a severability clause. And I write good contracts. And I know you know business, Representative O'Driscoll. And if you hired a good lawyer to conduct any matters for you in business, you would hire a lawyer who would put severability clause in that contract, just like we put in law. So it has, it says nothing about the viability of the law. You have no idea what a court could do 100 years from now. So including severability clauses in legislation or in contracts is not an indicator that you think the contract or the law is weak. You would just write a stronger one if that was the case. You include the severability clause because it's the right thing to do, to protect it for the integrity of the signers in the case of a contract, but to protect it for the cause of people who rely on these medications in Minnesota in the case of legislation.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably to the bill author, Representative Lesch. First of all, I just want to say I share your concern about rising health care costs. It's why I serve on Health and Human Services. It's why I ran. It's why I'm happy to be on this Commerce Committee as well. And I think it's a multifaceted issue, and it's very complex on how we address these costs. Drug costs, to my knowledge, have been pretty consistent in being about 10% of overall health care costs. And that's, I think that's a fact that's been for about 10 years now. I appreciate what you're trying to do, and I believe the situation with insulin is unconscionable, but my concern is that you're casting a very wide net with some of the parameters of your bill. And I want just one, because I know we have other people, so I'll just pick one thing that I'd like you to address on how you came up with $80, and again, the way I read your bill, and this is on page 7, any drug, patented, generic, or off-patent, which costs more than $80 a month. So if I take 80 and divide by 30 days, that's $2.60 a day.
Look at me.
That doesn't fall, I guess, in my opinion, as an unconscionable price for medicines that we all use, medicines that help us feel better and all that sort of thing. So where does the $80 and $2.60 a day come from that you and the AG's office could start, investigating per, I think, the terms of this bill? Can you comment on that?
Well, to be clear,
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Haley. To be clear, the general prohibition under Subdivision 3 does not limit the reach of the Attorney General in this case to those that fit simply the $80 piece. So these definitions as we have under here, that is one of many of how these are defined. A 30-day supply of the maximum recommended dosage, for any drug indication is $80 of the wholesale cost. So that's under paren 2 of subdivision 2, which says that this is an essential medicine due to its efficacy in treating life-threatening health condition. Or the full course of treatment would cost more than $80 of the drug's wholesale acquisition cost. So it gives a heads up to, hey, these are some of the drugs that we could be looking at. And I think that the reason why a static number is important is because, as was brought up to me, this is not so much one of those things that makes it more expansive. This is one of those things that limits it more. Because if you've got a drug that costs $1 and you double the cost to $2, that's a 50% increase. To a lot of people, if you didn't give them the dollar amount of what it was and they say they just increased the price of your drug 50%, they'd freak out. But when you tell them that, oh, it's $1 to $2, well, they'd probably grumble a little bit, but they'd be like, okay, well, whatever, I can handle it, okay? That's why we put the $80 in there, so we'd be sure of who we're getting at in attempting to avoid price gouging, you know, these penny ante pieces. As we all know, if you go into business, you want to make a lot. You want to make money off of a lot of very small transactions, not money in big chunks over one or two transactions. So the smart money is going in that direction. But in any case, in most how this bill impacts consumers, we want to make sure it's a situation where, because of this change, suddenly they're going to go without, and that's why we placed it at $80, or that's one of the reasons we placed it at $80.
Representative Haley.
Mr. Chair, are we going to vote on this bill today?
That is the intention.
And what time does the committee end?
At 4 o'clock.
Thank you.
President Haley.
I don't have any further questions since we're nearing our time. I know you have other people on your list.
Representative Tice. I'm sorry. I thought you shook your head.
I have a question. I think at the end of the committee, and we've asked, we've, as those who were here last night, our pain level is getting to a point. So either we come back this evening or we should just vote on this bill. Mr. Chair.
We only have one person on the list after you, Representative Mahoney, so unless...
We're just going to go 10 minutes more?
Hopefully not even that. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to make a statement because of the interest in time. Last night I had to meet my neighbor to get an extra pen, my injectable, because I forgot it. I'm really concerned about the bill because I'm afraid there might be unintended consequences. Some of my biggest issues with the meds are either my PBM, who says I can only use generics, and there are times I can get name brands with the rebates and such that the pharmacists get for cheaper. So that isn't always, you know, what drives the cost to some of my meds. I do have the option of switching pharmacies, and I have. But it's really interesting in how one of the pharmacies keeps trying to drag me back and trying to take some of my refillables, you know, my automatic refills back. So, you know, part of it is I'm afraid. I'm afraid it's going to drive some of my meds up. I'm really fortunate in that they're not really outrageous at this point. But as I said, some of my concerns have come more with who's, you know, what my PBM is doing, some of the pharmacy questions as well, and we're not addressing that as part of this. And I guess I'm not sure that there's a Senate companion, so I don't know how far this bill is going to go, but I would rather see us look across the board at everybody and not just one, because the cost of drugs don't just happen from Big Pharma. They do in some cases, but not always. And so I'm always hesitant about doing things like this because I'm afraid the unintended consequences are that I am going to have to pay more. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
That's the end of our list.
Just to clarify, I don't know who told you there's no Senate companion, but there is. So just clarify.
And that concludes the list. I don't know, Representative Lesh, if you had anything you want to say in closing.
Well, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll keep it short. I know you never say I'll be brief around here, because that usually means you're not going to be brief as soon as you preface it, but I will. Mr. Chair and members, I don't take any prescription medications, I'll tell you this. I'm a very lucky individual who doesn't really have to go to the doctor and doesn't rely on any prescription medications. I did take Zyrtec just over the counter when my wife had cats, but then the last cat died, and I don't have to take any more Zyrtec, okay? And I only had to take that once in a while, put the cat around. But my lucky situation is an increasing rarity. And part of the reason for that is because there are such amazing things that are being done by pharmaceutical companies, really impressive things. I told the story about the Sunday before I presented this bill in HHS, my mother had a major stroke. And they got to her right away with this clot-busting thing within, I don't know, like 4 hours or something. And the next day, she was walking around down the hall of her her living facility to come get us at the elevator, which I thought was absolutely crazy. And that's because of the amazing things that pharmaceutical companies have been able to do. And we want that to continue. What we don't want to continue is the price gouging that is causing people to be more sick and causing people to die. And we think that this bill, because it allows for the targeted and strategic lawsuits with respect to these, not a broad application, but we're using a scalpel, not a sledgehammer, to solve this problem. We think it'll be good for the people of Minnesota to make sure they have access to those essential prescription drugs, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Would you like to renew your motion?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Renew the motion to re-refer to House File 4 as amended to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and that is the last item on our agenda, and so we will adjourn.